Connecting the city and surrounding villages. You've found Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, bringing you an hour of the Cambridge food and drink scene. Our thanks once again to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Rosie Applin.
And I'm Alan Alder. And on today's programme, we look at two aspects of modern food. First, the high-volume industrial approach, which gives us things like chlorine-washed chicken. But the second is a look at the new opportunities for artisan-produced foods, which the forthcoming Cambridge Food Hub is being set up to promote.
We visit a newly opened cafe in King Street and a refurbished Indian restaurant in Cherry Hinton Road.
And we find out about the forthcoming Greek-themed evening at Robinson College.
But first, how does the idea of eating chlorine-washed chicken appeal to you? Here's the view of one person I asked at Cambridge Market on Thursday.
Yes,
yes, that's right, yes.
Excuse me, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio, and we're asking people if they would eat chlorine-washed chicken.
Not at all, no, certainly not, no.
Why is that?
It's just the thought of it, really. It's just that it sounds absolutely disgusting and unnecessary, really.
But chlorine-washed chicken could be on sale in this country if we start importing meat from the USA. I went to the Art of Meat in Arbury Court to ask John West about what it was and why it was done in the USA.
The American poultry industry, as standard practice, wash the carcasses of the slaughtered chickens with chlorinated water. Basically, it's a wash which will kill any residual pathogenic bacteria. I know they have a big problem with E. coli strains within their poultry industry. But this is, of course, a reflection of their practices.
What, they don't have the same cleanliness as we do here?
It's more that there, as far as I'm aware, there are no actual laws in America regarding welfare or the amount of the density that you need to stock chickens. Basically, they haven't got the same laws as us to provide welfare for chickens. So they tend to stock at a lot higher density. They're also growing enormously big birds that have been bred to produce huge amounts of breast meat. What the conditions for in the American poultry industry would be considered quite barbaric here. It's very, very cost driven. So people not only have to sell at a cheap price, but they actually get rewards from the big companies who own the poultry farms for producing more with less food. So the whole thing is actually geared towards production of breast meat at a very cheap price with low welfare standards.
So you deal with the outcome of the low, well, one of the outcomes of the low welfare standards by dipping your carcasses in chlorinated water.
Exactly.
That removes the incentives to clean up your practice.
Exactly, yeah. In this country, I mean, we've got very high standards for poultry, even in at the sort of bottom end of the price scale, especially compared to the States. So we won't actually be playing on a level playing field if they do start importing this cheaper chicken.
Yeah.
Whether the average consumer will worry about that or not is another thing. I know people are naturally wary of eating carcasses that have been washed with chlorinated water, but if you look at most salads, ready-to-eat salads and things like that, a lot of them are washed, pre-washed in a weak solution already. So, and to be fair, the American population have been consuming this, millions of them consuming this year on year, and there's been no problems. I don't actually have a problem with washing things in chlorine, but the production values, I think, are very different to ours.
Well, what do people in Cambridge make of it? Here are more views I encountered at the market on Thursday.
Hello, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio, and we're asking people if they'd eat chlorine-washed chicken.
No.
Why would that be?
I don't even have the bleach-washed carrots.
Right, you just think food should be left alone?
Absolutely. It doesn't appeal. Obviously, if I didn't know about it, then it wouldn't bother me. But if I did know about it, yes, I would avoid it.
So it's something you would not buy?
Yes. That's right. Oh, no. I only eat organic chicken.
Oh, do you?
Yes. I certainly wouldn't. But I don't want anything from the United States. Thanks very much.
No. Is this any help?
Any particular reason?
That just sounds poisonous, doesn't it?
Excuse me, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio, asking people if they would eat chlorine-washed chicken.
Oh, no.
We only eat free-range.
Only free-range, unwashed. Certainly not.
I don't know what... Unless I found out more information, I wouldn't know.
But apparently, if you start washing chickens, don't they immediately spread all the bacteria?
Yes, but presumably they're doing this in factories.
Chlorine washed, no.
Don't know.
Thanks very much.
Yes, I might rinse it afterwards. But no, chlorine is not so bad for you. Yeah?
Okay.
If you wash it off, it's good antiseptic. Yes, so I think that would be quite okay.
Are there any other concerns about food safety that...
No, but there's an interesting one, which is that in many other parts of the world, it's quite routine to do radiation treatment of packaged food. So you'd seal it in a package and then treat it with radiation. And it kills everything off and it preserves the shelf life. And it is completely harmless.
But it's not allowed here?
It's not allowed in the UK.
Yeah, and no. What sort of products is it done to then?
So meat products, cooked meat. Yeah. So it gives you a long shelf life for that, but it's just not allowed over here.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much.
Well, like everything, there's a lot to think about. Our tap water is chlorinated, for example, and that doesn't seem to do us any harm. And as the last interviewee said, there are other ways of treating food too. I asked John West about other processes used in the American meat industry.
Are there any other processes in the US which are not carried out here because we don't think they're right in some way?
Generally, the whole of the US meat industry is quite industrialised. So, for example, the use of growth hormones and finishing lots in cattle. I was talking to one of my wholesalers about it today, and these are people who are heavily involved in the UK cattle industry and beef industry. You know, they were saying a lot of the beef that is sold comes from cattle who have never seen grass. They're on these enormous penned plots where they're fed grain, given growth promoters, and a lot of the meat then it goes through tenderization processes before it's sold to the customer.
Tenderization involving some sort of chemicals or some
either,
sort of physical?
Well, generally mechanical, but some of it is chemical as well. The reason why, I mean, don't get me wrong, some of the steaks that you get in America are absolutely fantastic. They're heavily marbled, very tender. Personally, I think the ones that I've tried when I've been over there before have been lacking in flavour, but that is a result of this process and a result of the way that they actually raise the cattle.
And this animal welfare, the spacing for animals, I mean, you mentioned specifically poultry, but that is true for, say, pigs as well, is it? Or
yep, I believe so with the pig industry as well. Generally, welfare is less of an important factor for your average American consumer when it comes to meat, and of higher interest to British customers. I think long scale, if we do start importing low-cost meat from America, whether it's chlorinated chicken or beef, there will be part of the population who will buy it because, you know, on a price basis. But then again, I think the majority of British or English customers do have concerns about animal welfare. and we'll probably carry on buying British and looking after our local economies and local farmers.
I guess that some of the people who process meat will be less pernickety than you might be if you were actually going to buy some direct from a butcher.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, most butchers and the way that butchery in the past few years has gone, we tend to be a niche market selling better quality meat with good provenance to people who care about what they're eating. I see it as an affordable luxury. It depends on the wholesaler. If you're looking at someone like one of the big supermarkets, of course, they will buy cheaper and package it nicely, maybe put the name of a farm on there or something to make it look more wholesome. But they, you know, the lower end of their market, they'll be selling cheap meat. If you're looking at big catering companies who sell cheap poultry, then really it's a bonus for them. But it's unusual, in my experience, for a customer to walk into somewhere that sells cheap poultry that's cooked and ask about the provenance of that. I've never been into, say, fried chicken shop and heard someone say, well, can you tell me about the provenance of this chicken?
That was John West from The Art of Meat.
Acting on something Brian Davis, also at The Art of Meat, said, I discovered some details of an American patent. It's a process for tenderising meat, which, and I quote, includes the steps of inducing the brain death of a meat-providing animal and leaving the meat-providing animal substantially intact. The circulatory system is accessed and a perfusion fluid, generally free of melted fats, is injected into the arterial side of the circulatory system of the animal under moderate pressure. Blood and fluid are removed from the circulatory system through a separate vein, such as the jugular, thus cleansing the circulatory system of the animal, which acts to flavour or tenderise the meat therein. The final result is meat that is unchanged in appearance, but improved in taste, texture and tenderness. End of quote. Now, whether or not we get meat like that over here, if you want to feel comfortable with the meat you eat, I'd say you can't beat a good butcher who buys their meat locally.
Yeah, I think that sounds much nicer than yes, the alternative.
Actually, one of the Vox Pop people, who unfortunately I didn't record it, but she actually refers to the chlorine washed chicken as Trump chicken.
Now, a few episodes ago, I met with John Hodges. John's a local professor who, along with his family, were taking on the former Clown's Cafe site on King Street. At the time, everything was in a state of construction. You know, there was lots of scaffolding, workbenches, paint pots and so on everywhere, and they were gunning for a late August opening. As they said, you know, come back to us when we do open so that I could see a before and after effect. So, coming up now is what I saw after the before.
We're coming for a walk in Cambridge and then going to do a bit of shopping, and we were looking to go for coffee, spotted this and thought it looked great, and it is.
Hello, how are you? We have bacon, brie and red onion chutney and rocket, and some blush tomato, pesto and rocket. Cheese toasty with optional ham for 50p extra.
So what we're looking at here on the middle wall is this really gorgeous painting of Clown's Cafe as it was.
Well, we thought it'd be a tribute to the Sorcellas. Jenny and Michaela have been lovely to deal with. So we thought we'd have a painting done by a friend, Colin Wiles, who specialises in painting shop fronts and had an exhibition at Hot Numbers not long ago. So we thought we might have a sort of before and after.
Yeah.
That was John Hodges, and this is his wife, Carol.
This piece here is mine, a collage for the locker, and it's situated next to Colin's painting. So we've got a picture of the old shop front, which is quirky, and then I've done a collage to commemorate the starting of the locker. So we've sat them side by side
for a bit of fun.
This is our second day, so our opening was yesterday. So
how did the soft opening go?
Oh, that was great, actually. Friends, neighbours, people that have helped us with the restoration. We had about 60 or 80 people here. It was great.
Was there a big rush towards the end to get everything up and running?
Oh, yes, it was frantic. We set an opening date and then our other little problems arose and our builder was working overtime and the electrician and the plumber, you know, to get us finished and open.
Are you happy with how everything's turned out?
Yeah.
I don't think we could be happier.
That's Adam, John and Carol's son. He runs the locker. And next to him is his sister Naomi, who is helping out during the summer holidays.
The place looks amazing. Our builder, Steve Colhane, who's a local Cambridge builder, has got such an eye for aesthetics, so if you need a job done right, Steve Colhane's your man.
And it's like, obviously it's all really new for us, and like, he's just been so sweet, and like, he's really put his heart into it. Like, he was so stressed out when we were opening. I think a lot of why it's turned out so well is because like, he cares, and he's been really committed.
Yeah.
So that's been great.
Whose idea it was to open up a cafe together?
Okay, well, definitely not mine.
Dad had the idea whilst in Australia and went on a couple of how to open a cafe courses.
G'day there, mate.
G'day to you, Cole.
Right, you're going to show us some of these skills now, I believe.
Out where the river broke.
You probably heard we lived in Sydney for a while and spent quite a bit of time hanging out in cafes. But it was John's idea, really, and he's wanted to do it for about 10 years or so. You know, things came into fruition, really, when Adam, our son, moved back from America. And he'd been working in cafes in America and Australia and wanted to kind of settle back in the city.
You know, Adam's the manager.
I was living in America at the time.
It was Adam's suggestion to John, would they like to go into business together?
And Australian, like, coffee and cafe scene could be said to be a bit ahead of England's, like the artisan small batch brewed coffees, you could argue, started in Australia. So when I got back to England, I noticed it was starting to continue in that trend. So me and Dad thought, oh, well, we've got a kind of insight into how we think this is going to progress. So we thought we'd give it a go.
Funnily enough, Simon Fraser of Hot Numbers gave me a very similar story about 6 years ago. Again, his kind of eureka moment came from when he was going around the world, but Australia specifically, just like he said. There was something about the coffee and the cafe culture there that really inspired him to reproduce it here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We enjoyed spending time in these really quirky coffee shops and cafes over there. Yeah. And we thought, well, why not see if we could do it together? And such a great family project to undertake together also.
And how is your son finding it at the moment?
Oh, I think he's finding it a bit stressful, you know.
You're always making fun of me, and I'm going to cry.
Running a cafe is a new, very new venture for us.
Me and Dad foolishly thought we could be finished in a month from the very beginning, but it was quite a bit more than that.
Now let's talk about the food here, because you have a nice range of cakes and savouries as well here on the front. Are you a devotee of any of the things here yourself? Have you been testing them?
We've tried them all. I'm really a fan of the Norfolk Street Bakery. Adelia there has made lamb and harissa sausage rolls for us.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Lamb and harissa sausage rolls, which I hear are really good, but I didn't eat meat.
Yeah, I really highly recommend them. They also supply us a goat's cheese and spinach sausage roll. And that's the vegetarian option, and they're really good.
Adelia Fritzau. She opened the Norfolk Street Bakery about 5 years ago now. I remember cycling to her shop. It was 4 a.m, it was winter, so it was pitch dark, and it was pouring with rain. I got soaked to the bone, freezing cold. All that so that I could record the sounds of the bakery coming to life whilst the town was still asleep. It was only when I got there that I realised there were no real sounds to record, because dough and pastry doesn't really make a noise. I was an idiot. Anyway, back to Adelia. Now, she is Portuguese, but she also has a lot of experience working at a bakery in London prior to coming here to Cambridge. And I think she specialises in making her delicacies fusion between Portuguese and British style.
Yeah.
And that's what makes her quite unique. So it's really nice to have her stuff here.
Yeah, it's really good stuff.
Yeah, her sausage rolls are just amazing. We also use her white rolls for the sandwiches which we prepare. She's a great baker.
You'll have heard that we've been sourcing local suppliers, and my husband and John have been eating cakes all around the city for the best part of 6 months.
Well, our main sweet food supplier is called Ben Jones. He owns the Cafe Mobile. It's been going on the market square for a great number of years. He supplied us with some amazing cakes, some really delicious gluten-free brownies with white chocolate and raspberries.
And the blondies, which
and
like
and the white chocolate and
with
almond blondie. Yeah.
And raspberry, and they're like oozing with butter.
Nah, they're excellent. They're really, really
diet,
good.
They're really yummy.
They're stunning. They are really stunning. And they're not good for the waistline, but you know, if it's a Saturday, you know, what do you want?
And he makes us the brownies and what else?
We got lemon drizzle loaf, a delicious like walnut, banana loaf with dates, which is really, really excellent also.
And then somebody else happened to come and find us called Jane. I forget her the name. Adam, do you remember Jane's name? Jane? Apple Tree Bakery. She makes lovely cakes, and she brought in a whole range for us to try on Friday.
Yeah. Is that everything?
Let's not forget the drinks now, an important part of any cafe.
Oh, yeah. To start with, our coffee we get from Simon Fraser's roastery at Hot Numbers. They've developed this awesome blend of coffee for us. It's called Davy's Blend, as the cafe is named after my dog, Davy Jones. Our teas all come from T2, the big tea supplier in Australia. So that's one of the ideas we pinched from what's going on with the cafes in Australia, I guess.
I used to come to Clowns years and years ago and didn't even realise that it had closed down, and this place is new, and it's very nice. It's nice. They've got a nice sugar pot. Nice sugar pot. I like that.
And all the pots are by me.
Now, your dad has provided all of the pottery here.
Yeah, yeah. So he makes the cups for, like, the chai and the hot chocolate and stuff like that, and the sugar pots he's made. And, yeah, and we've got, like, some of his stuff on display at the back as well.
I started, before we went to Australia, 12 years ago with a night class, and I did open studios last year.
Oh, yeah.
I did a charity sale. So I gave all the proceeds to Jimmy's night shelter.
Yes.
And we raised a couple of £1,000. So we're thinking before this Christmas of we'll do that again here.
Yeah.
So we cycled past yesterday and spotted it on our way home and decided to come here today because we thought it looked like nice and bright inside. We liked the art that was on the walls, and we heard that they had a rooftop cafe as well that we could possibly come and sit in the sunshine, even though we haven't.
Speaking of upstairs, I haven't seen it yet. Should we go and have a look upstairs?
Yeah.
The upstairs here is a split level.
Yeah.
And you also have a little veranda outside.
Yeah. This is our sculpture garden.
Excuse us. Yeah. It's only our second day. So this is Cambridge Food Programme.
Yes.
So there's a friend of ours who's a sculptor. He's kindly lent us the first exhibition. And then we found this blue.
This is the same blue as the house that Yves Saint Laurent lives in Marrakesh, or lived in, I should say.
And Carol said it needed to be like a Mediterranean blue. But of course, you can't buy Mediterranean blue colours in England.
So you got into very fine detail here.
Well, yeah, we did, yeah. Every little thing, you know.
But it wasn't intentional, was it? Yeah, but once you start on these journeys,
went down all these paths of me ringing up and talking to the people that make this paint about how to use it on masonry.
Yeah. I have a white Americano, please.
I mean, that's the lovely thing about Clowns, as you'll know, it's been embedded in the community for such a long time. People feel very strongly about their relationship with it. And a man called by a previous customer, and he said that his girlfriend's grandparents owned a cafe here. There have been four families who have owned cafes in succession. So I suspect it's got a little bit of all those four families.
So I've got a pesto, tomato and brie sandwich on sourdough toast. It's really good.
They're stunning, you know, they're just really stunning.
We'd like people to come and check it out. And we want feedback as well on things we serve, suggestions for other things we could do. Yeah.
And the final ingredient, we'll see it really full of people. That'd be wonderful. So we're getting there. Yeah.
And how is it so far? Because this is a big family venture. Everyone's in it together.
Yeah, it's really good. It's been really stressful, but really good. I think we're all really proud of the way it's come out. And it's been actually really fun, like, team building.
Well, John Hodges, it's been great to meet you and your family and see all of this get up and running. This is now Cambridge's newest.
Yeah, Cambridge's newest. And becoming like a little cafe district, King Street. I mean, it's great that everything on this road is, it's all independent. It's very collegiate between the different people here. Yeah.
I'm Naomi Hodges.
And I'm Adam Hodges. So come down to 54 King Street and check out the locker. There you go.
Cheers.
Thanks so much. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.
It has become exactly what we wanted, and more, actually more. We are really pleased with the physical environment. Absolutely love it. So we're getting there. Yeah.
And many thanks to the Hodges family. We wish them all the best in their new venture on 54 King Street. As well as hosting regular exhibitions, they also have an alcohol licence and an acoustic music venue licence, so just like Clowns. And they'll be adding their own spin to that. That's The Locker, the city's newest independent cafe.
And on to Twitter news. My Persian Kitchen have tweeted a few minutes ago. They've got a pop-up tonight at Limoncello in Mill Road, and they've had some cancellations, so there are now 5 places available for tonight. If you want to get in touch with them, send them a message on Twitter at MyPersianCamb, C-A-M-B. Free and starting in 1.5 minutes' time at 12:30 at the Wesley Methodist Church, that's the one on Christ's Pieces, Food Cycle Cambridge is doing lunch. There's leek and potato soup, plantain curry and rice, which I reckon would be absolutely lovely, and there's a barrel load of puddings, loads of different puddings. And that is free, open to all. Donations are welcome, but you don't have to if you don't want to. We'll keep our eye on Twitter throughout the programme and let you know if anything else of interest comes up.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Coming up, the Cambridge Food Hub, a visit to Taj Tandoori on Cherry Hinton Road, and finding out about the forthcoming Greek night at Robinson College, plus our regular roundup of Cambridge food and drink news.
Well, many of us remember and still miss Pavitt's pies. These were made by Cambridge resident Carrie Pavitt in her own kitchen and sold at various outlets in the city. You're a pie man, Matt.
Aye.
Are you still missing them?
Yeah, they were really excellent, weren't they? I remember that Carrie, she won gold at the British Pie Awards in Melton Mowbray.
Yes.
This was 5 years ago. She had to give the business up, of course, when she was costing the moving production out of her kitchen and into a unit.
Yes, well remembered. Here she is explaining her reasoning from Flavour on the 9th of March 2013.
And there's quite a lot of equipment involved. If you get premises, you need kind of extraction units. You've got heightened environmental health regulations because you're working with meat products and those kind of things. So there's a lot of different things. And then your equipment, if you're going to market, if you're having market stalls and stuff, and making that work, there's a lot of different investment.
Yeah. Well, there are other food businesses in Cambridge now. Bread on a Bike is one, where production is limited by what can be achieved in a domestic kitchen. What is needed is some sort of intermediary. Moving from a domestic kitchen to getting a big industrial unit is often too big a step. So what's needed is an incubator kitchen unit. And the proposed new Cambridge Food Hub, an idea of Cambridge sustainable food, is planning to have just that sort of thing. Duncan Catchpole of Cambridge Food Hub explained this and the many other ways in which the hub will be able to help small producers in Cambridge when he came into the studio on Monday. And by helping small producers, it helps us as consumers to be more certain about the provenance of what we eat.
Cambridge has a rich community of small food producers and small food businesses, many of whom are literally operating out of their kitchens at home. And the Food Hub incubator kitchen units will offer those people that stepping stone to grow their business, and also hopefully encourage lots more people that have ideas of food businesses of their own to give it a go.
Right, so what sort of businesses would you expect then?
Yeah, it would ideally lend itself to those sort of cottage industry style things, so somebody making pies or a baker making bread, jam. I can see there being a good deal of output for conference catering here in Cambridge. The university puts on a lot of conferences and things, and I've been to them myself, and you often find that, you know, they, even if it's a conference that is talking about an issue of sustainability, you'd find that the catering for that event doesn't necessarily match that criteria, and, you know, it doesn't address things such as food waste or whether or not the food has been sourced locally, or whether indeed it's, you know, there aren't very many sort of vegan or vegetarian options available as well. So that's something that I envisage might be a key line of business for the incubator kitchen units.
And you also said it would be a storage place for locally produced food.
It'll have cold storage and ambient storage for food that has just come directly from the farms that are local to Cambridge, and from there it can be distributed throughout the city, sort of throughout the whole kind of South Cambridgeshire region, really.
And where would you envisage it being distributed to? The sort of the small shops, like, for example, the Farmers Outlet shop or the shop in Haslingfield, or
local shops and cafes for certain. But what we're really hoping to address here, as things stand, very little of the food that's used in large restaurants, schools, college catering, canteens, even the hospital, very, very little of that has come directly from local farms or has been sort of produced using sustainable production techniques. And one of the reasons that is the case is that the infrastructure simply doesn't exist to for those sort of local links to take place, and the food hub will be putting that infrastructure in place. And we know in particular that the Cambridge University has recently produced its own sustainable food policy. So this is something that they really want to try and affect themselves.
Well, this is terrifically exciting, and I think it's a great vision, but how realistic is it? I mean, is a building likely to be in place?
Our big news is that the project has moved on considerably. Earlier this year, I was approached by the managing director of Smiths & Hill, which owns a parcel of land near Hinxton, and where they're proposing a new agritech park. And they said to me, we really like the idea of the food hub and everything that you're trying to do with that. We feel it fits very well with our objectives for the agritech park, which is itself being has an objective to address the future of farming, to make it more sustainable, to address issues of climate change, etc. Yeah, well, they've basically said to me, you know, you can have the site, and they're also willing to put a substantial amount of money into the project as well. So, it really has moved on substantially from that concept stage to something that could conceivably be a reality within a couple of years' time.
And they are genuinely interested in things like organic foods, are they?
Yes. Well, the Smith part of Smiths & Hill refers to Russell Smith Farms, which is the largest organic farm in the Cambridge area. So a very, very forward-thinking and significant farm that wants to ensure that food is produced more sustainably in the future, and, you know, addresses this pressing issue of how are we going to feed the growing global population sustainably 50, 100 years from now.
Yes, and with good quality food. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So they've got this agri-tech park. What's going to be in the agri-tech park? What sort of buildings?
Yes, it will be a mixture of buildings and sort of field trial plots, and the kind of technologies that that they'll be looking at. It's really sort of futuristic stuff, such as sort of farming with drones, or use of drones and robotics in farming, or perhaps sort of innovative new solutions to sort of food waste, anaerobic digestion, all these sorts of things.
Yeah, so it'll be a sort of research based.
Mm. Yes, yeah.
Establishment.
Stuff that sort of blows my mind.
And what about within the site? I mean, would you have any prospect of growing stuff?
This is one of the things that makes the site at Hinxton really attractive for us, is the fact that, yes, there will be a field there that grows food specifically for the food hub. Not only that, you know, this field could be opened up to the public. It might, for example, be a community-supported agriculture scheme that that's just conjecture, but it could be. What I really like about it is because there is an objective within the Food Hub to provide a fantastic educational resource, and so that field could be a place that let's say a class of children from a local school could come along for a field trip to the Food Hub. They could go to that field, see food growing. They could then come into the Food Hub to learn about nutrition and sustainability, and then go into the training kitchen to actually get some food handling training as well. So very, very exciting proposition there.
Indeed. It sounds wonderful. It also sounds costly. Is the money going to be there?
Smiths and Hill themselves have been very upfront about that. They are happy to put a substantial amount of money into the project. We're not doing this at the moment, but eventually we will be running a crowdfunding campaign because we've got to put a bit of money in ourselves, and hopefully so virtuous are our intentions that hopefully it will attract some grant contribution as well.
I suppose there is a slight unpredictability about all ventures. Were the Food Hub to fail, were that to happen, would it drag COFCO down with it? Because a lot of people would miss COFCO.
Yes. I've got a good team of advisors on board, and yeah, the advice very much has been to, you know, keep the Food Hub and COFCO as separate entities, which would sort of safeguard COFCO and of course our employees and network of suppliers and customers that all rely on what we do to sort of safeguard that. So yes, if worst came to the worst and the Food Hub sort of didn't succeed, COFCO would still survive as a business and sort of continue doing what we're doing.
And also, as far as developing land is concerned, that's going to need council consent?
Yes, that's perhaps the one hurdle yet to overcome is that of planning permission. So it needs to. I need to stress at this stage that all these wonderful plans about building a food hub near Hinxton are sort of subject to planning permission. A planning application, I believe, is being submitted in September, and they're an anticipated 18-month period while that's going through the system. So we'll sort of watch that space with interest.
I'm sure. Is there anything that the people of Cambridge who like the sound of what you're doing, are they able to, I suppose, speak on your behalf in some sort of way?
There is one very, very special way that anybody that's listening to this who wants to support what we're doing can help, and that is literally to add their name to our growing list of supporters. At the stage we're at the moment, being able to demonstrate public support is going to be so important, not least with regards to perhaps that application for planning permission, but then also when we're talking to grant providers as well. It's going to be really important to be able to say, look, this project has 1,000, 2,000, whatever number that might be, people in the local area who think it's a good idea. So what we're asking people to do is to visit our new website, which is www.cambridgefoodhub.org, and there's a little form on there where people can enter their name and email address, nothing more than that, and it literally just, you know, the counter, you know, go. I think we're at something like 409 at the moment. So it would make the counter go from 409 to 410. There's no commitment in doing that. It's literally just saying, yes, I think the Food Hub is a good idea. I'd like to see it happen in our community. And it's just something brilliant that people could do to help us sort of get to where we want to be.
Right. I shall do it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Duncan.
That was Duncan Catchpole of Cambridge Food Hub, and if you want to show your support, as Duncan said, just go to their website, cambridgefoodhub.org, and sign up.
Yeah. Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio. We'll be keeping in touch with Duncan, and we'll bring you updates from time to time.
It'll be really great to hear more about the Cambridge Food Hub. It sounds like a fantastic opportunity for local people to really kickstart their journey into the world of food production.
Well, actually, when you think of the possibilities for Cambridge, for eaters in Cambridge, it is fantastic because, you know, one hopes that we'll get a lot more local produce of just really high quality and probably at a reasonable price as well. So jolly exciting.
Absolutely. Well, the Taj Tandoori on Cherry Hinton Road has recently reopened after a five-month break for renovation. I went along last week to meet brothers Saeed and Jalal, or Jules as he's known, to find out more about the changes they've made and the history of the family restaurant that's been part of the Cambridge curry scene since the late 80s.
I'm Saeed and I work at the front house of Taj Tandoori. Taj has been going for about 30 years and the building was not in the greatest of states, so around the back there was some structural damage and stuff, and as a result we were actually in a position where we had to help because it had become unsafe. So as we started the work there, I think the decision was made that we might as well just go right through the building and just get everything done, and then 2 weeks ended up being 5 months and it ended up quite a large figure spent on the refurbishment, but the end result now we're very pleased with and we're very glad we did it because it's something that we can give back to our customers who've been supporting this restaurant over so many years, and now we feel like it's something that we can give back to them that they can look at and they can be pleased with. And the response we've had since we've opened as well, I think all our customers are really enjoying it. And we're just slightly outside of the town, so like, you know, this area is very much a community area. It's very much a family restaurant, and we noticed that when we closed because the amount of support that we got from the local residents, the amount of well-wishers, the amount of people that were like, when are you opening? When are you opening?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then when we opened, people were coming in and giving us hugs. They were like, oh, you've opened. I haven't had a curry in 5 months. Where you been? We've been overwhelmed by the support our local community has given us, really. We didn't know we had that much love there.
The thing is, you know, we're quite well known for a few of our dishes. We do quite a few signature dishes as well. I mean, one of them being like a staff curry, which you're not likely to find anywhere really.
So that's the one that you guys would choose to have?
Yeah, and it's usually just on the bone, because normally in the restaurant you tend to go boneless with most of the curries because people get a bit funny with bone and stuff. But in the kitchen, and generally with Bengalis, when they have a curry, like, we just have it on the bone. Whether it's lamb, mutton, chicken, it's got to be on the bone.
Yeah.
It's just so much more flavour when you cook it.
So people kind of coming back for that, asking for it, getting something different every time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the stuff goes something they like. Apart from that, we have a few other very, very popular dishes. We have one called a Taj Puri, which is made with some aubergines, long strips of chicken tikka. Apart from meat dishes as well, we do a lot of vegetarian dishes. So we have quite a high number of Indian customers that come here as well because they love one of our dishes, which is called a dal makhani. It's like the king of all dals, really. So it's quite rich, creamy, very divine taster, really. So that's something which people come back for. And our paneer, which is Indian cheese, fairly similar to like halloumi, you know, so it's fairly bland, but unless you put the right spices and things in it to uplift the flavours and make the paneer taste nice. So those dishes we do very well with, and people come back for those as well, which is really good. And
yeah,
it's nice having signature dishes, so you know that they won't find them elsewhere, and you know, we're very passionate about the quality of the food as well.
Something I noticed on the menu is you have the scale of different, like the hotness scale. So
yeah, that was Jules' idea.
So why did you decide you needed to do that, or why did you want to do that?
There's a lot of newbies out there, or people who, even people who are like, they usually have something like maybe not even mild or extremely hot, but something in between. They want something slightly hotter, and I found some people they just don't like to talk too much or ask too much. So I thought, you know, try and help as much as we can on the menu.
Maybe it'll help them take the steps.
Yeah, exactly. Gradual steps. Yeah, because everyone's a little bit worried. Because with chili, it's a funny thing. You know, you're a bit frightened if you take something too hot. You're just going to ruin your meal, and you're not going to be able to eat it. But if you can see, you know, like, oh, I can take gradual steps, and you know, maybe I'll go for a sixth, maybe seven next time. Yeah, something like that.
So you two are brothers. What's it like working together? How do you find it?
It works well because I'm back of house and he's front of house, so we don't get in each other's way.
So we don't tread on each other's turf, so which works quite well, really. So
generally we seem to be on the same wavelength. We're always, you know, we're always tasting food. We get the camera out. We're taking pictures. While Rob was doing a Facebook post, I'm like, yeah, and then we're trying something, and then he's like, yeah, maybe a little bit more salt on this, or something like this, or a bit more chili in this, or this one's lacking a bit. So it's really nice. We kind of bounce off each other.
I think the thing is, we're both very passionate about the Indian food industry and curries, and you can probably tell by looking at our sizes. So,
Thank you. For the listeners, that's big belly.
That is the sign of good
good feed.
Yeah, I think you know, it's nice that we work together and we work well together as well, and generally we agree with each other, which works well.
So you've recently had quite an exciting new refurbishment, and what are the main changes that customers will notice to the decor?
Everything from the sign outside, which we've tried to make look a bit more sort of classy to match the clientele that we have coming through the doors. You know, as soon as you walk in, you'll notice like the bar used to be on the left, which is on the right now, and we tried to go for more sort of like a royal regal look because it's called the Taj, so it made more sense for us to do that. As soon as you walk into the main bit of the restaurant, that's where you'll notice the biggest changes. In the old Taj, the seating was a lot more cramped in, and we had like a false ceiling, so we've got rid of all of that now. So we've got these really lovely beams now, so it just adds to the grandeur of the place, really. And also been nominated for the British Curry Awards, which in itself, you know, we're really proud of, and we're just hopefully wanting and to see if we can be nominated or shortlisted rather. To be a finalist, if we do, then that will really be the icing on the cake for us. And you know, it's nice to get recognition for all the hard work you do. Fingers crossed, see what happens. Lastly, we'd like to thank all your listeners for taking the time out and listening to this show. As the name of your show is called Flavours, this is definitely the place to come for flavours. We're using different flavours, and please come in and see us, and we'll be more than happy to accommodate for you.
Come and taste the flavours.
Absolutely.
Actually, on that note, I was going to ask, what one dish would each of you pick from the menu? Would it be the staff pick, or would you pick something else? If there was one dish you could have that's your favourite one.
What about the dancer?
I like danzak, definitely. I enjoy having danzak. But apart from the danzak, we have a really, really yummy dish which I also like. It's called lamb mysuri, which is one of our most popular lamb dishes. Well, it's we use mutton, so we slow cook it for about 4 or 5 hours to make it so tender. And we basically have a nice olive pickle which we make, and we put it into the, and it uplifts all the flavours of the mutton. And it's actually, you know, really tantalises those taste buds. It's really yummy. So definitely I would recommend customers to come in for that.
Well, thanks very much to Saeed and Jules for chatting to me. As you can tell, they're great fun and well-known by their customers. The restaurant's looking really light and airy with the new high-beamed ceiling. It's really stunning work.
Every fortnight, Bums on Seats brings debate and discussion on the latest movie releases. From blockbusters to art house, our panel of reviewers are passionate about film.
There's one thing in common, and that's that I think they're all absolutely brilliant.
Well, you can see the ending by watching the trailer, because I was surprised they show it in the trailer.
You wouldn't know it was the ending if you hadn't just said it was the ending.
And we'll agree to disagree.
No, I don't agree.
Hosted by Toby Miller.
We take the latest cinema releases for a dance and a drink and report back on which ones have turned our eye and captured our heart, and which ones will be blanking in the street if we happen to pass them.
Join the team. Alternate Saturdays at 12 noon on Community Radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
And Bums on Seats will be here next Saturday. A couple of tweets. Thirsty has tweeted to say that the beer garden in Riverside is now up and running in the sunshine. And the beers on tap today are Howling Hops, and that's from Hackney, Lost and Grounded from Bristol, and Von Freud from Germany. And one more. There's also a bit of debate on the price of grouse.
Grouse.
Yes, the price of grouse. It's the grouse season. Mark Poynton's saying that they are a bit expensive at the moment, but the prices will come down. I don't know how much.
Phew.
great relief in the studio. They're £12 each at Cousins, the butchers in Newnham at the moment, if anybody wants to go there and get some. Now, changing the subject somewhat, back in June, Robinson College in Grange Road put on a Korean supper club. And later this month, in fact, on the 22nd, there's to be a Greek evening. Well, I went to Robinson College to ask catering manager Alex Moreau how the Korean evening had gone and what's on the menu for the Greek night.
We've done our Korean evening a couple of months ago, and it actually went very well. The feeling I had from all the guests, that they were very pleased with the way the evening was organised. They were very pleased with the quality of the food and the service. The supper club feel that, you know, I was hoping to be able to give to our guests. It did work, and we were very pleased at the end of the evening.
So, and the Greek one, which is coming up on, what's the date of it?
The Greek evening is coming up. It's on Friday, the 22nd of September, a few weeks away. And as you say, it's a Greek extravaganza. The setup is going to be fairly similar for the Korean evening. There will be a welcome drink, Pim's, with a Greek twist. It's actually an aperitif of ouzo, served with cucumber, mint, and apple juice. And ouzo, it's an anise-flavored distilled Greek spirit. And I would say you can compare it to pastis or yes. sambuca. But I think with the refreshing, you know, mint, ice, apple, and cucumber, we can really get it right.
Well, that sounds interesting. Can I just ask you, I mean, to me, ouzo does taste of pastis, but you probably know more about pastis than I do. Is there much of a difference between them?
I wouldn't say there is much of a difference, and I think it's all down to how people will drink it. I would say that south of France, if you have a pastis, it's going to be a lot stronger. There is a lot less water than if you were to drink it in the, let's say, in the Loire Valley, for example, because people are not used to it as much. Mm. And I think that my experience of drinking ouzo, it's really much like the south of France, where there is a little bit of water and it's really, really strong in anise flavor. But it's a bit like when you eat Marmite, is you like it or you hate it. So I think making it a little bit of a more fruity, longer drink is going to be attracting probably more people as well. So that's why we decided to go for that.
That's an interesting idea.
So there will also be a non-alcoholic version that we will be offering as well. So with the welcome drink, again, our chefs will be in hand, you know, presenting the food, presenting the mezze. So there will be a selection of three mezze. The first one will be a fried halloumi with a lime and caper vinaigrette. So halloumi is a Greek Cypriot cheese. It's made from goat and cheese milk. And in terms of the texture of the cheese, it's a little bit like mozzarella, so it's got this layered texture, and it's kind of got a salty flavor. One of the things that I personally do when I do a barbecue, I always grill halloumi on the barbecue because it's fantastic with a beef steak and things like that. So that will be the first one. The second one will be a mini phyllo cheese pie. So it's shaped in a triangle, and it's actually called tiropitiaka. So it's very traditional in Greece.
The phyllo pastry is quite a Greek favorite.
It is, absolutely.
Favorite,
so it's layered of phyllo pastry, and then it's kind of rolled in a triangle shape. And also we will serve some homemade hummus with coriander flatbread that will be baked while the customers are having their drinks as well. So we will try once again to have a lot of kind of interaction between our staff and on the guests to make it a very convivial evening, but also make it as relaxed as possible. Mm. For the main courses, it will be a Greek assorted plate. So there will be two meat choices or meat option in the plate. So the first one will be a chicken souvlaki. So it's a skewer of marinated chicken in lemon, olive oil, garlic, and chili and cumin. And also there will be a beef stifado, traditional beef stew. It melts in the mouth and it's full of fresh herbs and Mediterranean flavor. Then there will be obviously the vegetarian option as well. Will be the grilled vegetable and falafel souvlaki, and there will also be a porcini mushroom stifado available as well. The two main courses will be served with Greek salad, charred grilled pita bread, and some tzatziki dip as well. Following on that, there will be a dessert. It will be a traditional baklava cheesecake with cinnamon cream. That will be the option to end the meal.
I must say the vegetarian options sound quite tasty as well.
I think you're absolutely right. I think sometimes, you know, the chefs can almost explore a bit, try to be a bit more experimental in terms of the vegetarian option, because they do it in smaller quantity as well. So I think they can try to bring a bit more flavor and try to use a bit more of their imagination. So I think it sounds very, very good as well. The tickets will also include wine during the meal. So there will be two glasses of wine included in the meal. And once again, we are working with Alice Archer from Cambridge Wine Merchants to pair up our food on drinks as best as possible. We are still finalizing the wine, but what I can say is that the red wine will be Santali Organic Cabernet Sauvignon 2011. And it's actually coming from Chalkidiki, so it's the north of Greece. And it's a red wine that's full of red fruit aroma, and it's got that light, spicy, sweet oak taste. We're still discussing the white option. So as I mentioned, a Greek evening will be on the Friday, the 22nd of September. Tickets, including two glasses of wine of the on the aperitif, is sold at £39.50. And all the informations are on our website at Robinson College, Cambridge.
Yeah, and thanks to Alexis Moreau. And as he said, it's on the 22nd of September, and those tickets are once again £39.50. And that's Green Onions, of course, introducing us to the news section. So let's begin with jobs, and over to you, Rosie.
Cambridge Brewhouse on King Street is looking for a kitchen porter, so pop in with your CV. This is a permanent appointment.
And Prana, the very successful and award-winning Indian restaurant in Mill Road, needs permanent waiting staff. Experience is preferred, but on-the-job training can be given. Email your CV and phone number via their website.
On to events now, and right now, on Jesus Green, it's Oktoberfest with German beers and food. Entrance today is £5, it's free tomorrow.
Tonight at Thirsty's Beer Garden on Riverside is Steak and Honour. They'll be flipping from 5 till 9 p.m.
And next Saturday, Romano's is popping up at the Plough in Shepreth, and that's a really nice pub, and they're there from noon until 11 p.m.
From 5 p.m. tomorrow until the 15th of September at 5 p.m, the pint shop is closed for a refresh.
Next weekend, from Friday till Sunday, is the Queen's Head Beer Festival. That's in Newton, with beer, ice cream, street food, music, the lot.
On the 12th of September, our Cambridge wine merchants in Cherry Hinton Road, Keiriko Tapas, with a night of food and drink from the La Rioja region of Spain. There'll be five tapas and five matching wines, and that will be a very reasonable £32.50 per head. To book, phone Cambridge 214 548.
On the 14th of September, the Tickell Arms in Whittlesford has a cheese night, a choice of six mains plus unlimited cheese. It's £30 per head, so book on Cambridge 833025. The mains are sea trout, sausage and mash, pork tenderloin with prunes, rosemary and mustard, smoked haddock and leek fish cake, squash and goat's cheese dumplings. And there are six types of cheese.
And finally, on the 16th and 17th of September, it's the Cambridge Food and Garden Produce Show, once again on Parker's Peace. There will be cooking demonstrations, local chefs, fruit and vegetable competitions, stalls, a bar, and of course, entry is free.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Flavour. If you missed bits or you just want to hear the whole thing all over again, there's a repeat at 7 a.m. tomorrow, and the podcast is early next week.
And remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter, @flavour105. And you can follow Cambridge 105 Radio itself, @cambridge105.
But that's all from us, and we'll be back on the 19th of September. Until then,
goodbye.
Bye.